This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I'm delighted to have back in the studio with me the one and only Cindy Sheehan. She's still doing her activism, of course. She now has her own radio show on the web called CindySheehanSoapbox.com. She's the founder of the group Peace of the Action. That's peace as in the opposite of war. And she's the author of two books about myths of America and the case for revolution. Cindy Sheehan, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Hi, Matt. It's just great to be back in Madison, and it's great to be back here.
Well, it's always good to see you. I follow you on the web and in the news, and I'm always a great admirer of what you're doing because you underscore how important it is for even just one person, but one person also acting with others just to put it all out there and protest these wars and stand up for what we believe in, which is a better, more peaceful, more just country and safer world.
Yep.
These books, I don't know much about your books, so I wanted to ask you, and I'm embarrassed to say that I haven't read them, because I usually try to read the books before guest comes on. Myth America, the 10 greatest myths of the robber class, or the 20 greatest myths. What's the biggest myth, or what's one of the biggest myths?
Well, I wrote 10 greatest myths the beginning of last year after Obama was inaugurated. And I saw the policies of the Bush administration continuing without much of an outcry from, you know, the so-called left. And so I started to think, what makes us do that? What makes us every 4 to 8 years believe in a system that is so corrupt and really cancerous, no matter who's in charge of the system? And so I wrote that. I went on a 40-city book tour, and I realized that through the discussions I had in these towns that I didn't really hit the myths enough. And so then I came back last summer and wrote the 20 greatest myths of the robber class. And the myth I start out with is a foundational myth, I think, and that's that America's the greatest nation in the universe, not on the planet, not in history, but in the universe. And so that makes us believe all the other myths, because most good people, no matter if they're on the so-called right or the so-called left, we really believe that if our country does something wrong, it must have good intentions. And so that's not the case. And so I wrote the 20 myths. We have to expose the myths and dispel them. And then I think we could have true change for the better in this country, whether it's through, you know, I call for grassroots, very localized revolutions, you know, and of course they're nonviolent revolutions, but taking back our economy, taking back our governments, taking back even our food systems. We have to do that if we truly want to have a more healthy, not only a more healthy United States of America, but a healthier world.
Cindy Sheehan, this foundational myth, as you call it, is really profound. It's this myth of what I call the American superiority complex.
Yes, exactly.
And the idea, as you say, that we don't, you know, everything we do is because of good intentions, or if we do something that isn't working out, it's because it's an accident.
Right,
or it didn't work out the way we expected.
It's an aberration.
Or a rogue operation, or something. Not that it is elemental to the way U.S. foreign policy operates.
Right.
How is that myth propagated? How has it become so ingrained?
Oh my gosh, it's propagated through our schools, through our media, through I talk about in my book how Martin Luther King Jr. celebrations have turned militaristic, you know, where they roll tanks down the streets in the parades and they fly the Blue Angel planes overhead. And I tell a story about when I was in second grade, and my second grade teacher asked us a question. And this was back in, 1964. They asked a question. She asked us a question. If a communist came up to you and put a gun to your head and told you not to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, what would you do? So, of course, I raised my hand and I said I wouldn't recite it. And I had to stand in the corner. So even when I was 7 years old, I was being called unpatriotic, a traitor to this country. So, yeah, it's done through fear mongering, through Madison Avenue. You know, distraction is a really good way to keep us not thinking about, you know, if that our country is doing these crimes and these crimes against humanity. So there's just a lot of ways that that this myth is propagated. And the number one way it starts in the family.
And almost every person who runs for office, you ran for office against Nancy Pelosi, mm-hmm. but almost every other person runs for office just recites it as though it's the gospel.
Well, right. And, you know, we really have to think about what we're saying and about what we're teaching. It's nationalism. It's not humanism. And this is what my work is getting to is humanism. One of the other myths is if the U.S. kills somebody, they must have deserved to be killed. And so until we in America realize that everybody on this planet has the same existential imperative, then nothing's going to change either. Because our leaders could care less. They could care less about the people they're killing. They couldn't care less, I mean, about the people in our country that are being oppressed and being economically disadvantaged. So we have to be the ones that have to care.
Yes, this idea in wars that our casualties count and nobody else's casualties count is something that goes way back, and it's still with us today. You're doing a lot of work writing about and talking about empire too, mm-hmm. which is a concept that most Americans don't want to hear about, or to the extent that they want to hear about it, there's a new, not so new, I suppose, over the last 10 years, this idea that the United States is the first benign empire.
Well, you know, even talking about what's happening in Arizona and about the immigration from Mexico to the United States, whether it's legal or illegal, people in Mexico, one of the things I point out in my book is they don't want to come to the United States. They want to be able to earn a living in Mexico. They want to be able to grow their own crops using their own seed, not be pushed off the land by our huge agribusinesses. And this is all related to free trade agreements. And that's just an Orwellian name because it's not free trade. It's highly regulated and highly weighted towards, you know, the large multinational corporations and against the people. So instead of having these draconian laws, we should check into why they're forced to move up north to support their families. And, you know, we do have an empire. We have almost 1,000 bases around the world. That's like the Roman outposts. It's exactly the trajectory of the Roman Empire, what the U.S. Empire is taking. And then we see our mistake in Afghanistan, where Obama is tripling the commitment that George Bush had. The USSR fell because of Afghanistan, and they were right on the border of Afghanistan. And so we really have to look at this military corporate empire that we're spreading all over the world. And people aren't just dying in the Middle East because of our empire. They're dying in Africa, Asia. So we really have to, and not only that, starting at home. You know, the chickens truly are coming home to roost now.
Speaking with Cindy Sheehan, I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Why is Obama escalating the war in Afghanistan?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. And he said he was going to do it when he was running for president. I mean, that was one of his promises. And so he's just fulfilling a campaign promise. And you saw many anti-war progressive activists that supported Obama saying, well, that's one promise we hope he doesn't keep. But he has kept that promise.
Were they just deluding themselves? Or did they think, well, it's worth it no matter what?
I think it was, you know, and that's another question that I've been really investigating, asking myself and trying to come to grips with. For 8 years, did we have an anti-war movement or did we just have an anti-Bush movement?
What's your answer to that?
I think we had an anti-Bush movement. I've been, like you said, I've been still working really hard in the movement, in the peace movement, and the anti-war movement, and in the alternative political movement, even if when we have a new president, and it is really, really hard to organize. It's really hard to get people out in the streets anymore. There's such a lack of intellectual honesty, I think, when it comes to this, a lack of integrity. And so my whole focus since Obama's come to power is to get us back to the reality of U.S. policies and not personality. And I started to actually try that when George Bush was still president, because I ran for Congress against Nancy Pelosi. She's supposedly the most liberal member of Congress from the most liberal district, which of course are also two myths. She's not, well, it depends on how you define a liberal, but you know, she's a politician, she's a centrist, and the Democrats in San Francisco are centrist too. So I started to try and pull people away from partisan politics to, you know, humanistic politics. And it's just been very difficult. And so now, these same people who 15, 16, 18 months ago were saying, well, we have to support Obama because he's the peace candidate and he's better than McCain, they're starting to go, oh, geez, I guess we need to start organizing something because he really is fulfilling his promises. And not only is he increasing in Afghanistan, he hasn't fulfilled his promises for the withdrawal from Iraq, and we have a nuclear option on the table still for Iran. So the U.S. policy, I hate to tell people, it's not really directed by the president.
Who is it directed by, Cindy Sheehan?
Well, you know, I just wrote an article today called Our Complex. And we have a military-industrial complex that has its tentacles in every segment of our society, from schools to the media. And I was in my research, you know, I've even found places like Wisconsin that are really out there trying to rein in or trying to bring those defense dollars to Wisconsin. It's gone from being one of the lowest. Well, it's still one of the lowest, but it's gone from being 48th to 40. So Wisconsin is climbing up that ladder of it's our economy.
The Pentagon
it's what
gravy
our economy,
train.
The Pentagon gravy train. That's what the economy is based on. And most states get a lot of their revenue and a lot of their jobs from the military industrial complex. So it's just a big problem that has, in these years since Eisenhower warned us about it, has just got its fingers everywhere.
But if Obama wanted to, could he have bucked the military-industrial complex? What would have happened to him if he said, sorry, folks, Afghanistan's a mess. We're getting out. We're getting out of Iraq faster than I thought. We're going to not have 1,000 bases around the world. Maybe we'll have 10.
Right. Well, you know, it could... You know, well, for me, I believe that the Democratic and the Republican nominee wouldn't be the nominees if they hadn't already sold out to these entities a long, long time ago, or these institutions it is institutionalized in our country. But of course he could say, he's the president. He could sign an order. What would happen to him? What would happen to him? You know, it could go from anywhere to assassination like Kennedy, or I believe that these institutions destroyed the Carter presidency. But still he could, I think that he had enough of whether it was genuine or whether it was manufactured. What do they like to call it?
Mandate
to come before the American public and say, this isn't what the real controllers of the U.S. want, but this is what I'm going to do. And if he would come out and just sit down and talk to us about that, you know, who knows where our country would be headed in this direction. But I'm not sure that that was even what he would have had that as an intention to start with.
I saw on one of your websites that you wrote that he tied a cement box around hope and drowned it in the Potomac.
I wrote that?
Mm-hmm.
Did I write that?
I think so. Someone did. It's a good line.
It's a good line. I write so much. Sometimes it's hard to.
I think that's
a really good line.
It is, yeah. You should own it anyway.
Okay. Yeah, I wrote that for sure.
But I think his idea of running on hope and not defining hope gave him a whole lot of latitude to say, well, you know, people would say, I want him because I think he's better than McCain. Other people would say, I want him because he thinks he's above partisanship. I mean, uh-huh. There are a lot of things. What about that better than McCain thing you mentioned a little bit earlier?
Well, first of all, I think that the whole hope thing was one thing. I think the change is the slogan that he had that was really ill-defined. And what can change be? Change can be bad change. And so he had a multi-million dollar Madison Avenue campaign that was almost like the selling of the Iraq War to the people. We were sold that this was an alternative, that Obama was an alternative to the Bush policies. And we had two candidates running for president that we didn't have to say, well, at least they're better than McCain. We had Cynthia McKinney in the Green Party, Ralph Nader as an independent, who were true alternatives to the Bush or McCain stain that we've had for the last 8 years. But if you run as anything better than Bush or anything better than McCain, I have a 2-year-old grandson that's better than Bush or better than McCain. So, you know, should we put him up for office? So that's just saying that we set the electoral bar so low in this country. And when the presidents get to, even if they win over 50% of the vote, that's only over 50% of 25% of the people that actually go and vote. So, you know, we have a very low participatory system anyway. And then the only reason that Barack Obama had this energy was because of the corporate media and was because of this Madison Avenue selling. It was like you have to go and buy a new toothpaste because your old toothpaste isn't as good as the minty fresh toothpaste. And I usually don't say toothpaste. I usually say a different product that women use. But, you know, that's exactly where we are. He's not Bush, but he's a new and improved minty fresh Bush.
I'm speaking with Cindy Sheehan. Of course, I'm Matt Rothschild of The Progressive. You're listening to Progressive Radio. So you mentioned Cynthia McKinney and Ralph Nader and you yourself having run against Nancy Pelosi outside the two-party stranglehold on an electoral system.
Right.
You did better than McKinney and Nader did, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But you got what, 18%?
17% of the vote, right.
Which is
quite
an accomplishment, I have to say. So what's your take on the possibility of breaking through this two-party stranglehold?
I think it has to be done we have to start locally. We have to start in our city governments, we have to start in our county governments, and we have to start in our state governments. I think, like you said, it's a stranglehold, and we need publicly funded campaigns, we need instant runoff voting, we need hand-counted paper ballots, we need all of these things, we need term limits. I'm convinced there's a lot of controversy about that, but I'm convinced that's one of the reasons that our government is so, corrupt right now, because people go to Washington, D.C. and they think it's a life. You know, they think it's their career. Instead of being public servants, they're career politicians. So we need all of these things, but they're not going to happen from the top down, because we're asking the people that are profiting and doing very nicely in this system to change the rules. In San Francisco, we have all those things I just mentioned. And in California, we have term limits. And we're trying to push what we have from San Francisco out to wider California. And then it'll spread across the country and go up. It's not going to be from the top down. So I think also one advantage of being involved in local politics too is that we do have more of a chance to have the people represented than the corporations, and you get to celebrate victories. We rarely get to celebrate victories. It's more glamorous to work in federal politics, but it's more effective to work in local politics.
I want to go back to Afghanistan for a second. You've been doing a lot of work in organizing opposition to these drones,
right?
These drone attacks, slay stations, you mm-hmm. call them. Tell me about that campaign.
I think that it's, first of all, I just want to be clear that I'm not for manned bombings of aerial vehicles. I'm not for other kinds of warfare. But this robotic warfare is not just aerial vehicles, but they're spreading to ground robotic vehicles, swarm things that are like little bugs that fly around in swarms, that they can do all kinds of things, from spreading biological warfare to surveillance. And to me, sitting in, and this is the way these are viewed in the middle, in like Pakistan, where they're particularly used, they're viewed as particularly cowardly. And we have people thousands of miles away sitting in such places as Creech Air Force Base or near Langley, Virginia, the CIA, and they're controlling these drones and dropping bombs on people that have killed thousands of innocent people. And this is something that we can also intimately tie into the Obama administration to organize around, because people say, oh, he didn't start the wars, even though he has escalated them, and he hasn't done what he promised to do in Iraq. He's the president now. They're his wars. And billions of dollars, there's another request for $33 billion coming up. But from 2004 to the end of 2008, there were 23 so-called drone attacks in Pakistan. From the time Obama was inaugurated to today, there's been 76. So that's more than tripled if you take into account the time too. So he's dramatically increasing that. And that's another thing. All my opposition from that comes from, well, but we're saving American lives. And this is where we need to educate people too, that the people of southern Afghanistan, northern Pakistan, their lives have exactly the same value as one American soldier life.
You were kicked out of a congressional hearing on this issue.
I was.
I read that all you were doing was holding a sign. What did the sign say, and why were you kicked out?
There was a lot of activism during the Bush administration in hearings, you know, especially Code Pink would go and they'd hold signs, they'd get kicked out. So it was kind of come to an understanding, as long as you just held a sign, a small sign, you didn't wave it around or stand up, that was okay. And I actually wanted to listen to the hearing because I'm very interested in the subject. But of course, I wanted to make the humanist and the peaceful stance known. And so I put drones kill kids. And I hung banners in the Smithsonian around the drone exhibit that say drones kill kids. And it was Congressman John Tierney from Massachusetts. And he kicked us out of the hearing. Didn't have any intention of disrupting. And that was the day after I got out of jail. I was in jail for 52 hours in Washington, D.C., and I got arrested in front of the White House. And this is probably the first time this has ever happened, but I have a stay-away order from the White House. Hmm. And this, you know, Matt, I kept on thinking during the Bush administration that he would actually get a restraining order against me, because I spent so much time in Crawford or in Washington, D.C., organizing protests around him. Nothing like this. I never had to spend one night in jail in Washington, D.C. I had to spend two nights in jail this last time, and now I have a stay-away order from the White House.
So you can't go with a sign out front the White House?
I can't go I can't step foot in a perimeter around the White House. And if I do, I go to jail for 6 months. 6 months for exercising my freedom of speech. And so they're saying that they can't say, they can't control what I say, but they can control when and where I say it, which is also controlling what you say.
I hadn't heard about that. That's
isn't that amazing? Astonishing.
Your civil liberties. We have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I want to get your best sense, Cindy Sheehan, as to what people can do. I was at your site, and this relates to you being arrested. You said, I know for sure what doesn't work, marching around in circles and shaking our fists at empty buildings on the weekend in D.C. or spending a weekend as a guest of the D.C. criminal justice system.
Right.
So if that doesn't work, what does work, or what should we do not knowing what works?
Well, if we could have the same kind of numbers and energy we had today that we had back in 2005, 2006, where we could call a protest in D.C. and have hundreds of thousands of people, I think that if it didn't work, that would clearly demonstrate to our country that there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans, because we have a democratic tyranny now. Why aren't progressive things getting passed? Not just ending the wars, but things like single-payer health care. Why aren't those things being passed if we have a democratic tyranny? I think that we need to start, like I said, organizing locally to start taking back control of our own lives from Washington, D.C. and from the military-industrial complex. I think that one thing that the peace activists that are still involved should be working on is counter-recruitment, because for the first time in 6 years, our military is fully recruited.
It may be thanks to the recession, too.
The economy and the perception that Obama is different than George Bush.
So counter-recruitment, this would be in the schools?
Going to schools, going to these, they have these things that the recruiters are in malls and they have like video games, going to places like that, talking to people, getting involved in your local Veterans for Peace or Iraq Vets Against the War, getting those kinds of people into schools. And also look at my site, Peace of the Action, P-E-A-C-E of the Action. We're really trying to get together something in July in Washington, D.C. We're going to put another peace camp up on the lawn of the Washington Monument, we hope. That got shut down when I was in jail last time. And just start to do organized, targeted acts of civil resistance. I think that that's where we have to, the movement has to go. It has to go to committed civil resistance. That's what has peacefully changed empires.
So nonviolent civil disobedience,
yes.
That's what you're calling for. And getting the machine to stop working the way it works.
We got to throw our bodies on the gears. That's what Mario Savio said back in 64 in Berkeley. And we look back 50 years, 40 years later, and, we see the machine is still grinding on. It's healthier than ever before.
Yeah, unfortunately, it does seem to be that way. But Cindy Sheehan, we're out of time, but I really admire your ability to throw yourself on the gears of that machine and do it over and over again, and to think so clearly on these issues. You're an inspiration to me, and I'm sure to many of our listeners on the show today. So thanks so much for being my guest.
Oh, thank you, Matt. It was my pleasure.
That was Cindy Sheehan, of course, and you can get more information about what she's doing at peaceoftheaction.org. That's peace as opposed to war. And CindySheehanSoapbox.com, because she does radio herself. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.